you have trouble remembering that name.
There was a song in the 80s about it. It goes, I wouldn't if I were you. I know what she can do. She's deadly. Remember this one? Yeah. Oh, here she comes. She's a man eater. You could dub in like.
Hello and welcome to Savor. I'm Annie Reese.
And I'm Lauren Vogelbaum. And today we're getting a little bit experimental.
A little bit weird, which is appropriate because some people might describe Asheville as a little weird.
I believe that's on like their merchandise, so yes.
I believe it is, yeah. And on our recent trip to Asheville, we got to eat so much of the local food, which is sort of what we're talking about today, what it is to be local.
Right, because we don't just mean that we ate at places that are locally owned and operated, although we certainly did that. It's almost impossible not to, because the city keeps big chains out for the most part. But everywhere that we went, menus called out the regional farms and producers that they sourced their ingredients from.
And these menus don't really include the term local, because it's just assumed that it will be.
Yeah, it's almost more specific than that, which gets to be a little bit of a joke in the industry.
This is local?
Yes, absolutely.
I'm going to ask you just one more time, and it's local?
It is.
Is that USDA organic or Oregon organic or Portland organic?
It's just all across the board, organic.
The hazelnuts, these are local?
How big is the area where the chickens are able to roam free?
I'm sorry to interrupt. I have exactly the same question.
4 acres.
And one of the things that stuck with me from our time in Asheville is that more than once, the phrase once-in-a-lifetime meal came up. And when I say once-in-a-lifetime meal, what do you think of, Lauren?
Oh, something very fancy, covered in gold leaf and diamonds.
Of course.
Sure.
I think of caviar in space.
Ooh.
Or something from the Titanic, still preserved, still around.
Oh, like one of those bottles of wine that they pulled up that are probably still good?
Exactly. But it turns out that it's much more attainable than that.
Yeah, you have probably had a once-in-a-lifetime meal, but maybe you weren't tuned into it.
I always talk to my readers about once-in-a-lifetime opportunities to eat, and those happen all the time. And so that's the kind of thing that is a cornerstone of Asheville. It's just these opportunities to eat very special food. And I'm always saying, you better do it, because it might not be there tomorrow.
That's Stu Helm, a food writer and tour leader in Asheville. He was talking about this monthly dinner series, but pointed out that it's never really the same, that meal, those ingredients, never happens again. So a once-in-a-lifetime meal isn't all that rare, but it doesn't mean that it's not valuable.
No, not at all. The once-in-a-lifetime meal is sort of like a photograph of a place and time, just as similarly shared and made by the people who are part of it, the growers, the makers, the consumers. And I think that's something that gets left out a lot, the people you share the meal with, the people that made it possible, and all of the family traditions and influences behind that meal. Here's Stu again.
I always tell people it's a three-way partnership between the food growers and makers, that would be the farmers, and then those that make things like jam and sauces and whatnot. The food distributors, and that would be the restaurants, the cafes, the bake shops and stuff like that. And then the eaters. The eaters are a really important part of our food scene. Of course, we all know that the farmers and the makers need to work with the restaurateurs in order to keep it local, keep it fresh, keep it nutritious, keep it interesting. But the eaters have to be a big part of that, too. We have to be willing to eat weird stuff. And we have to be willing to spend more. Local food costs more money.
And we heard a lot of the same sort of thing from several farmers and producers, including Jen Perkins, co-owner of Looking Glass Creamery.
It's more expensive for a chef to do it. It takes more of their time and it takes more energy. And for those people like John Fleer who do it in such a sincere and committed way consistently all year round, makes a huge difference in the culture, in our ability to survive. And there are others in Asheville, and Asheville just has that passion for it, and lots of restaurants are supporting it.
John Fleer is a rock star chef in Asheville, if you haven't heard of him.
Yeah.
He also has very strong opinions on mayo, which we, like, stumbled onto a little randomly. But that's not why he's a rock star chef. It probably is a factor.
Oh, yeah. He's Dukes all the way, by the way.
Oh, so much. So much. No, the rock starredness has more to do with Fleer's dedication to supporting local producers and farms, which you can see on the menus of his restaurant Rhubarb and bakery cafe pantry The Roux. He's known for using local ingredients in high-class dishes to make Foothills cuisine.
Foothills, referring to the Appalachian mountain cultures that Asheville grew up around and out of. They're isolated and have a reputation for being impoverished or backwoods or worse than that, but they are really rich in tradition and happen to be smack on the second most biodiverse temperate region in the world, so they've got a lot to work with.
Yes, they do, and the result, as we can personally attest to, is delicious.
A Rhubarb and The Roux are two of the places we were really lucky to visit. We had these carrots. We had, as Dylan would put it, carrots you care about.
We cared about them quite a bit.
We did. Mm-hmm. There was a cheese plate with some of the stuff from Looking Glass Creamery.
There was a squash cassoulet.
Oh, I forgot about
it. How could you forget about it? It haunts my dreams.
I just went to a place.
You did.
And yeah, so there and everywhere else in town, we had these dishes that were based on what local farmers had to offer the chefs that week.
And of course, what local farmers offer and the dishes resulting from that is going to depend on the season. Graham talked about that.
We're hyper seasonal, so something will come and go really quickly. My team and I forage as well, so we go out in the woods and gather whatever's like popping up kind of thing
to
put on the menu as well, so it makes it easy to change. And one thing I love about Asheville, comparatively to Atlanta or even or San Francisco, there's four very distinct seasons here. So in San Francisco, you could have a tomato on the menu till October, November. Here, it's like it comes and goes and it's gone. You know, I personally don't eat anything that's not directly in season. It helps you kind of appreciate it a little more, because if you eat it out of season, it kind of gets convoluted as to what it's supposed to taste like. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
So if you eat a squash in January and it's like, oh, this is kind of shitty, but you don't appreciate it as much, you know, you kind of miss it if you wait until it's perfect.
This all might sound kind of obvious, but it is radically different from the way that most people consume most foods, you know, from big grocers or from restaurants that source produce from all over the world so that we can have tomatoes and summer squash in January in the winter, or winter vegetables like celery or Brussels sprouts in the summer. And it gets more granular than just like a really good tomato, although that's a thing of beauty, because you also have to take the microbiome of an area into consideration. When you're talking about locally made cheese or bread or beer, these products are flavored and made possible by fermentation, by
bacteria poop.
Our favorite thing.
And yeast poop.
So you're talking about flavors coming from bacteria and yeast that are local to the area or even to the kitchen in question. It's as far from mass production as you could get.
Yeah, and it was enough of a shift from the mainstream that I struggled to grasp it at first.
I'm not really sure. I'm trying to formulate a question here because I hadn't really considered how you were talking about, like, each dish, if you're only making things in season and if you're using things that are the bacteria and yeast to this region, then you can't necessarily recreate that anywhere else. Like, it's very unique.
No. Yeah. So we do ferments and stuff. And every place I've moved to, it takes a second to, like, figure it out. Like, we had bad juju in this building when I came here, and we had to get it out because everything I tried to ferment or anything turned awful. So there's natural bacteria everywhere, and sometimes it's not good bacteria. So, you know, figuring that out, and like we were talking about butter, I started making butter in San Francisco, tastes completely different, you know? Like, literally that place, the chef, Sean Baker, that I was working with, had such good juju in that restaurant that you could leave a pint of cream out for 4 hours and it would turn into cream fresh. But then moving to Atlanta and trying to do it, I was like, God, this doesn't taste the same. And then I realized it's like, it's not supposed to. We're all the way across the country.
And there's a word for the thing where an area, a piece of land, has characteristics that influence the savor of the products that were made there.
Oh, I see what you did.
I feel like we need like a title line ding. The word being terroir. It's perhaps most commonly heard in the wine industry, but it came up a lot.
We heard it from the folks at Etta Rhine.
They're a local distillery creating stuff like Amari and rye whiskey from nearly endangered local grains and traditional folk medicine herbs. This is Chris Bauer, one of their owners and founders.
So what we try to do here with this spirit is, again, capture a very distinct flavor that highlights our regional plants, our regional flavors. We like to use the term terroir.
We also heard it from the folks at Local Chocolate Empire, French Broad Chocolate.
Which obviously doesn't get their cacao locally, but still. This is one of their owners and founders, Jael Radigan.
The definition of terroir that most influenced us is a sense of place.
Turns out there's a lot to Asheville's sense of place. You can walk mere feet from a suburb into a forest and find something that influences the cuisine. And we did.
Oh, yes.
We walked mere feet into a forest and found something edible thanks to local forager Alan Musket.
You heard from him at the top of the episode, and you will hear more from him after a quick break for a word from our sponsor.
And we're back. Thank you, sponsor.
Yes, thank you.
And we need to talk about Alan Musket, owner of the company No Taste Like Home.
The company does foraging tours around the Asheville area, and Alan's been harvesting what grows there for over 20 years. So we knew we had to talk to him about the taste of Asheville.
Yes, we did. And he had a reputation around town.
Everybody knew Alan.
Yes, they did. We had 1 hour set aside with him, and we would later learn that was incredibly ambitious of us. As we walked into the woods explaining what we were trying to achieve, Alan was already trying to get us to take a moment and appreciate the nature around us.
So we're out here in Asheville to get material for a bunch of different episodes about, we're not sure yet. You know, we're kind of figuring that out as we talk to people about just, you know, how the food scene here works and what makes Asheville, Asheville, and why it's cool and why it's not cool and, you know.
Hold on, can you back up? Look around.
Oh my goodness. I was watching my feet as we were watching it.
Yeah.
We had almost walked right by this very large carved wooden forest totem.
Yeah, it reminded me of the house Squidward lives in on SpongeBob.
I don't understand that reference, but it was like sort of in tiki style.
Yes.
And it was standing just a couple feet into the brush right off of the path. But y'all, we had booked 13 interviews in the 4 days that we were there. And so I was in go mode. We all had to kind of readjust.
Including our schedule after that because we missed our next interview.
Oh, yeah. Spoiler alert. We were out there for like 2.5 hours with them. But no, encouraging people to readjust is kind of Alan's whole gig, to slow down, to appreciate what a place has.
Agriculture, by my definition, is working against nature. It's about sterilizing, right? It's about believing you know what is good and that everything else has to be pushed out of the way to make room for it. And then we plant what we are used to. And so Europeans came, and we still today eat plants from Europe that aren't, not native, but naturalized here. Because there are a lot of things naturalized here that came over with Europe and they thrive here. But the reason we have to fertilize our plants and weed them is because they don't thrive without our help. So we should be eating what grows without our help. And that I don't call agriculture. I call that permaculture.
And yes, this is a whole other level of what it can mean to eat local.
What a lot of us don't realize is that just because you grow something in a place doesn't make it local. 90% of what we consider local food, I said earlier, like isn't designed to grow here, which is to say it doesn't thrive on its own. So I don't consider that local food.
He gave us a crash course on his style of foraging, both practically and philosophically. It's niche, perhaps, even for Asheville, but really put those concepts of terroir and of meals or moments being irreplicable into perspective. But let's back up. To illustrate how far we had to travel, like mentally, to reach Alan, it helps to know how we physically got there.
Yes. Here's the conversation we, along with super producer Dylan, had when we first got back from Asheville about how we first met Alan.
So we take this lift out to the woods.
Yes. And our lift driver is concerned about us because it's not really an address. It's just like a street name. And he said, meet us in the silver convertible. Correct, Annie?
He said, meet me at the silver convertible.
Okay.
This was a text that I received. And for a moment, I thought, perhaps that's a place?
No.
In Asheville? No, it was a silver car.
It was his car.
It was, yeah. But he didn't specify that in the text.
He did not.
Yeah.
He just said, meet me at the Silvo Convertible at this general address.
It's kind of a dead end at the end of a neighborhood.
Yeah.
That had, and there was a gate on the pathway that we were supposed to go down.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was padlocked.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It wasn't, like, insurmountable.
No, no.
Yeah. But yeah, so the Lyft driver, like, looked at that and, like, looked at us and was like, so you guys don't know this guy. Are you okay? Are you going to be all right? Should I stick around?
We knew pretty quickly we were going to get along with Alan. Here's us finding the very first mushroom he showed us.
What is this guy? Oh, he's a fun guy. Oh, I didn't even mean to. It starts already.
Well, I'm glad you got that one covered. The short answer is that's the Dyer's polypore. It's somewhat edible, which means some people get a stomach ache. But it's good. It's to die for because you use it. Yeah.
Oh.
Wow, this is not going to be a tough crowd.
There was also promise of a mushroom rap.
A rap about mushrooms.
Uh-huh.
He did not disappoint.
No, he did not.
Stay tuned after this episode for that. But in the meanwhile, he also did not disappoint in his lesson plan. He presented us with four myths about foraging. He argues that foraging, it's not dangerous, it's not unsustainable, or too much work, or unnatural. He also had seven reasons why people are becoming interested in foraging, or interested again. And we don't have time for all of those today. We'll have to release the whole interview or just about as a bonus sometime. But he did tell us that his tour business had doubled five times over the past 7 years.
To me, the essential thing, I tell people, even if you don't leave with anything in your basket or nothing goes in your mouth, you're still fed. So we're like a plant without roots, you know, and we are literally shriveling. You know, you can have four walls and a roof over your head and still be homeless. That's why my business is called No Taste Like Home. Because that's what it's about. It's not about, like, getting a bunch of food and turning this into another supermarket, you know, in a shopping spree. I mean, that draws people and it's fun, you know? But what that is a taste of is literally the Garden of Eden that we all lived in. It wasn't a myth, and it isn't a myth. This is it. Like, it exists.
Alan also likes quizzes.
About half of the information that he gave us, he asked us to guess at. Mm-hmm. Or not to guess at, but to take from observation, to listen to the land around us, to the plants themselves.
Yeah, he thinks that we, the royal we as a society, not just Lauren and I and super producer Dylan, are so far removed from our food, from our surroundings, from nature, that we're missing everything, pretty much everything. We don't know how to listen, to observe. We don't know. We think we do. But we don't.
We're domesticated, you know, we're caged. Like, we live in a zoo. That's where we live. We live in boxes, you know. I say it's not just the food that's wild and free when you eat this, you know?
If you're going to forage, Asheville is a great place to do it. In and around Asheville, there are over 150 common wild edibles.
Common?
Yeah, they're a lot more than that, but common. Foraging can make you a decent amount of money, too. On his website, Alan gives an example of someone who picked 75 pounds of stinging nettle in about 9 hours and got it sold for $450, which comes out to $50 an hour.
Though it's certainly reasonable to just collect a bit for yourself and your table. On the last leg of our walk, Alan stopped to show us this peppery, leafy green, and as an afterthought, almost, he just collected a bunch because he said he hadn't brought his lunch.
See, there's plenty of that if we wanted a salad.
And one of the perks to taking a foraging tour with No Taste Like Home is that they partner with a few restaurants in the area. You make a reservation, anything you gather on your tour, you drop by a few hours before your table is ready, and they'll make you an appetizer out of it for free.
Which is pretty great.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Wow. A once-in-a-lifetime meal takes a certain willingness to be open-minded, to experiment. That's one of the reasons these meals have flourished in Asheville. And we'll get into that after we get back from a quick word from our sponsor. And we're back. Thank you, sponsor.
Yes, thank you.
Let's jump in with a quote from Graham House.
People that come to visit Asheville, I feel like, are okay being weird. They're like, oh, I'm in Asheville. I need to be weird because everybody here is weird. So they kind of step out of their comfort zone a little more.
The distillers at Etta Rhein, who are experimenting with Amari, also agree.
An Amaro, plural Amari, is an Italian style of this bitter herbal liquor. Frenette falls into the category. They're fascinating. We've got a whole episode on them coming up. But basically, Amari are these secret recipes based in local folk medicine. And the Etta Rhein guys, Rhett Murphy and Chris Bauer, are keeping up that tradition, but with Western North Carolina botanicals.
We could not do what we do here, not only like in a different bioregion, but also in a different sort of like cultural
community.
Place, different community. You know, this exists here because of what Asheville is, as much as the soil and the dirt and the biome. It's the people that allowed this to happen. And that's the culinary scene, the art scene, the cocktail scene, the brewing scene, the social consciousness scene, the small farm thing, the general excitement and willingness to go out of your way to support your friends or other small businesses in the region. That allows us to do this, whereas we could be in southern Appalachia and not in Asheville, and this would be a bad business decision, you know?
There's a lot of love spread around here, you know, and a love of craft, you know, a love of craft, artistry, you know, love of the land, agriculture. Yeah, we're extremely lucky to be a part of this community.
Artistry and love of craft are a huge part of Asheville's DNA, whether it's architecture, music, or food. We spoke to the pitmaster over at Buxton Hall Barbecue, Elliot Moss, and he talked about how his love of art led him to opening a restaurant.
I guess I come from an art background. As a child, I always thought I'd be an artist, and I feel like I'm pretty artistically creative. And, you know, I didn't really know what I wanted to do for a living. My dad was a welder. I knew I didn't want to stand in no hot welding shop. So, you know, I pursued some art, and music was always a big part of my life, collecting music and just listening to it. And so I was watching a lot of Food Network, you know, just cooking at home, cooking for my mom and dad and girlfriends and seeing their faces, I guess. And, you know, coming from a family where food is just always tried to force down your throat for love, you know, it's just, my family always wanted to feed me. And then I got a job as a chef, and I worked in the open kitchen, and I could see, you know, people eating food and smiling. I could see instantly if they liked the food or not. And I think all artists really just want gratification and for the work that they've done. And cooking food, you can see that instantly if somebody likes it or not. And then opening Buxton, I think it went more of a kind of a big installation art piece for me. I got to create this whole space, you know, the colors and things on the walls and what the kitchen's going to look like, what the menu's going to look like, and shirts ideas. And it's a lot of places for creativity to happen in opening restaurants.
Speaking of cooking shows, Stu Helm thinks that Americans are becoming more adventurous eaters, and he credits things like the Food Network and the Travel Channel for introducing more people to a wider palate.
We also spoke with Jamie Ager, a fourth-generation farmer and the co-owner at Hickory Nut Gap Farm, which is famous around Asheville for their meats. We did the interview out on their land, like our podcast studio for the day was the edge of a forest next to a brook. We were just out of earshot of the children's summer camp that Jamie's mother runs on campus. We all, like, pulled up a rock.
It's fun, and it's exciting, and it's adventuresome. So I feel like people are, you know, more stepping out of their box and looking for that creative artistic experience that a chef provides. And Asheville's got those people. And Asheville's the kind of town that, you know, it's becoming more like you can just get a job. But people that wanted to live here, you just had to figure out how to make it kind of work for yourself. You had to be an entrepreneur. You had to get through the money. People that live here are artistic types. And so a lot of chefs were like, yeah, Asheville's great. Let's start a restaurant. And it's just kind of blossomed into an artisanal place to do business.
Speaking of artisanal, And it's really not a buzzword, and we're not being advertorial here. As we said in our intro to Asheville, artisans helped populate the town when they came to build the Biltmore Estate back in the 1800s. But yes, speaking of artisanal, Annie, when we were with Graham House of Sovereign Remedies, he gave you a little bit of a paradigm shift, didn't he?
Yeah, I had a moment of, whoa. We talked about that when we first got back, and we were sorting out our thoughts. That interview for me really opened my eyes to, I think I've always thought of food as not art. And a lot of times it isn't, but it very much can be. And when you hear about Asheville, one of the things that comes up a lot is the art. And I was just sort of separating the food from that. But talking to him, I had a moment of, you really should be including the food scene in that whole discussion of art. His kind of determination and interest to use local ingredients and to create whatever you can from that was really kind of inspiring.
It was. We found ourselves all kind of drawn into that.
Yeah, to the promise of something special, of that once-in-a-lifetime experience. So, listeners, we would love to hear from you. Have you ever had these once-in-a-lifetime meals? If you would like to get in touch with us, you can. Our email address is hello@savorpod.com.
You can also find us on social media. Our handle on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook is @savorpod, so get in touch. Thank you to all of our guests today and to Landis Taylor and the whole team over at exploreasheville.com for helping us find them, and further to our co-executive producer, Christopher Hasiotis, for helping us find them. Thanks, as always, to super producer Dylan for making our jobs easy, and our other co-executive producer here at Stuff Media, Julie Douglas, for all of her good advice. Thank you to you for listening, and we hope that lots more good things are coming your way.
He also has a mushroom rap.
Oh, yeah. Four verses. It's accompanied by some breakdancing moves in between the verses, a little bit of beatboxing. There's a costume involved that he didn't put on all of because we were just
audio.
On audio.
He used his car hood for
he did.
Jumping and for rhythm.
Oh, I'd forgotten that entirely. How did I forget that? That was so good.
And he moved around a lot. He was the Lin-Manuel Miranda of the woods.
It's a pretty accurate description.
Okay, this is parental guidance suggested.
Okay.
And there's like four verses, so you ready for this?
Oh yeah, I think so.
Yo, I'm the mushroom man, and this is my story. You better listen up, and it won't be boring. Once hunting mushrooms was so hard for me, but I got a field guide. I mean, my homies, now that I had graduated, I commune with nature, because I'm so well acquainted with the nomenclature. If my college just made movies, I'd be sliced alone. I don't need a microscope, I got a microphone. On my dumpster diving days, they are behind me. At the school assembly, that's where you'll find me. On stage, microphone in my hand, and the children munching mushrooms all across the land, because they know they got the power to feed themselves. They're putting money in their pockets and food on the shelves. Cause in Russia, there's children, there's 7 or 8. They bring it home, my mama cooks it, puts it right on the plate. She don't have to be checking if they mess up. They know all the poison lookalikes. They know what's up. Now back home, the chicks be coming to my adult classes. They're checking out the mushrooms while I'm checking there. They're lining up front center, come to all of my shows. What you got, go ask the mushroom man, you know he knows. It's where the people push and shove, and when I'm serving my treats, they say, who needs a hamburger? This is better than meat. I got all the fancy restaurants begging for more, because what you getting from me, you can't get from the store. I mean, the chefs go crazy when I bring them my stash. Gotta take another basket just to take home the cash, because their minds start spinning when they're licking the pan, because they've been hit by a bullet from the mushroom man. Check it out. Now some people be complaining that I'm raping the woods, because they never been acquainted with my personal goods. If you came to my classes, then you start to see, you pick a mushroom off the ground like picking fruit off a tree. Like a monster in a storybook, I'm telling you, you cut off one mushroom's gonna grow back
two.
So I might be castrating, but they still get to mating, because the fungus still be growing down in the substrate. Boom.
Last one. I don't have to be walking around toting a gun. I got a fistful of fungus, put you on the run. If you down with me, we'll be smoking grass. But if you mess with me, I'll put a cap in your ass. It'll take you 2 days to get the scoop that I put the poison mushroom in your soup. You'll be on a stretcher, I'll be on the road. You just ate a toadstool and you're the toad, because that's the way I do it on my MTV. Get my mushrooms for nothing and my chicks for free. Boom!
Bravo! Bravo!
Wow. That was excellent.
Heck yes.